For a very long time, I did feel like an outsider in my own home until I started to like assimilate. I learned very basic Russian, so that really helped. But that also means like leaving your past convictions behind and being a little bit more open-minded to assimilating to your own community instead of having your community assimilate to what you think America should be.
You're listening to Coney Island Stories, the oral history podcast from the Coney Island History Project.
I'm Charles Denson, director of the Coney Island History Project. Welcome to Season 2 of Coney Island Stories, our podcast produced from oral histories in the History Project's archive. This season's theme is growing up in Coney Island through the decades from the 1930s to the 21st century. In Episode 8, the final episode of this season, we're sharing the stories of narrators who grew up in Coney Island or came here from nearby neighborhoods in the first decade of the 2000s. The new millennium began with the opening of a $30 million ballpark for a Mets farm team on the site of Steeplechase Park. A contest was held to name the new team, and the Brooklyn Cyclones was the winning name. Whenever the Cyclones won a home game, Astroland Cyclone Roller Coaster enjoyed a surge of business. Soon after Mayor Michael Bloomberg took office in 2002, he set his sights on Coney Island. He envisioned world-class attractions and hotels surrounded by high-rise residential development on vacant amusement land. A year later, the city formed the Coney Island Development Corporation to devise what was called the Coney Island Strategic Plan. The objective was to make Coney Island into a year-round recreational oceanfront destination by rezoning it. The ensuing zoning battle kept Coney in the headlines for the next 6 years as speculators bought and sold land and preservationists and stakeholders offered alternative visions for the future of the People's Playground. Our first narrator, Ahmed Hussein, first experienced Coney Island as a boy in the 2000s when his family moved to Coney Island and opened a business in the amusement area. He recalls helping out in his father's store and befriending the arcade and game operators who were their neighbors.
When my parents first had their business here, we started around the spring, and that's when I finally saw Coney Island come to life. So it makes sense, it's a seasonal place, and it was interesting to see so many things become open again. And I'd seen all the arcades, and I was amazed. So the arcade was the first destination for me. It was amazing for me to know that you could just put in a quarter and play something. I remember the first day I was cleaning the shop up with my dad. There was a lot of garbage in the shop, and there were a lot of quarters. So he said whatever money I found on the ground, I could keep it. And I guess that was my payment for me helping him clean up the shop. It came out to be something like $30 worth of quarters. So initially we first sold candy bars until we could get drinks for the fridge. And then my dad had gotten his liquor license. Then he started selling beer and it just took off from there. The second place where my dad expanded to was half convenience store and half ice cream parlor. We had like 16 flavors. I was the ice cream boy, yeah. So wherever I could, I also helped fill the sodas, like the fridge, stock up the fridge. But mostly what I did was ice cream. And I think about it now, if I was in a store like that and I saw a kid scooping ice cream, I'd be like, this is interesting, because it's not something you see every day. So I wonder what the people's reactions were then, you know, to see 8-year-old scooping up ice cream. I even had my own register. I didn't have to work if I didn't want to. So what I mostly did was, my dad didn't really pay me a wage. It was like 50 cents an hour. He would give me like $2 or $3, you know, just for the arcade. But normally I couldn't wait. So I just put my hand in the jar. And I would take like a couple dollar coins and I would just go to El Dorado Arcade around the corner and just play some games, win some tickets and get some prizes. But when we had the store, there was Shootout the Star on the left side of the store where it's the Adidas place now. at the Shootout the Star, I became really close with the guy who worked there. His name is CB. He was like kind of a mentor to me. He would always give me pieces of wisdom, and he taught me a lot of things that help me now. Morals, values. I think around 2004 to 2006, Coney Island still had that vibrancy. I mean, there was music blasting everywhere, and there was just a vibe there, you know, like it was really like the people's playground. And then something happened where a real estate agency had bought out a lot of properties, and then it just became dead again. And a lot of the people that I knew had left. There was an arcade that I went to, which was run by a guy named Donald. He's also like a really good friend of mine from that time too. And we still see each other. His arcade was part of that whole building. That building was owned by the landlord from my dad's store too. So I guess he had sold out the building, and with it, all those stores that were there. And then they demolished that building and built something else. I guess from that time, there were new vendors and new companies coming in. It's more corporate now. Like, there are chains. It's like more for like tourists. And definitely the composition of the crowd is different too. In 2004, 2006, it was really like a lot of locals. I mean, not that it's bad that tourists are coming, it's great. It's just that the things that are in Coney Island now cater to a different crowd. And it doesn't help that things are expensive in terms of like rides, the food. So I guess that really bars a lot of the local people from coming here because it's gotten really expensive. When I was a kid, I really enjoyed that everybody was so friendly to you, all the vendors, all the people who worked at like the games. They were like my friend, even though I was just an 8-year-old kid. I felt like I'm just a kid. Why is anybody going to take me seriously? But they entrusted me to do things for them, just things like watching the games for them. It was like a neighborhood of its own with all the people who worked at the games and the rides. And we all knew each other, and I would get free rides and stuff at places. It's kind of not like that anymore. The people are still around, but they're like weathered, you know? They're wondering, I guess, what's going to be next for Coney Island.
Spurred by the success of the Brooklyn Cyclones ballpark, Coney Island saw improvements in the early 2000s. Peggy O'Neill's bar and music venue opened on the ground floor of the stadium. The Kaufman family, who ran batting cages in Go-Kart City, built an 18-hole miniature golf course on Stowell Avenue. And the MTA began construction on a new $250 million Stowell Avenue subway terminal. New York Magazine called the Coney Island and Brighton Beach shorefronts hip places to live and featured the Cyclones baseball cap in its style section. Our next narrator, Bonnie Kong, recalls moving to Coney Island as a young girl in 2000. Her parents had bought a single-family home on Mermaid Avenue from the Estella Development Corporation, which was a success story for building homes on vacant city-owned land since the 1980s. Kong describes being among the first Chinese Americans in her new neighborhood.
When my family moved here in 2000, we were like one of the few families that are Asian American. And right now, if you walk down Mermaid Avenue to Main Avenue in Coney Island, you can see like all these businesses that are like Asian American owned. Coney Island was building just like single family homes for like first time home buyers. My parents saw an ad and thought that was a great opportunity. We really didn't have ties to your neighborhood, but we saw it as a great opportunity to like actually own a house. I visited amusement park before I moved here with my family. So we moved here when I was about like 10 years old. So that was certainly a big shift. Only just like, you know, one moving from a one-bedroom apartment to like, you know, having my own room, that was basically a big deal. So the neighborhood I lived in was predominantly Chinese American, only because it was a neighborhood like that's outside of Chinatown. So just like coming from that was very different. So, you know, when I started fifth grade here, as of my first full school year, I was basically one of the only Asian Americans in my class. In sixth grade, I actually started in a junior high school also in Coney Island called Mark Twain. And now school, that's like a gifted and talent school. So basically, most of Southern Brooklyn, or all Brooklyn, kids would take a test to get in. So that was definitely a big shift. That really just exposed me to different people in the area. My parents were probably the biggest influence for me. My parents basically barely had like high school education and came to America. So the most important thing for them is like they basically started from nothing. How do they build their way up? And then obviously they're doing like somewhat well for someone who didn't barely had a high school degree. They have jobs. Both their kids were able to like attend college. They own houses and stuff. So just like being able to like start from nothing and just like really move up, it just kind of made me think that anything is possible. My parents are from southern China. My father had a really interesting story. He basically fled China because it's, you know, a communist country. And then he swam to Hong Kong and was able to gain like admissions into America because he was considered a refugee. So I would say my parents, when they first came to America, they were definitely a little hesitant to leave an area like Chinatown because they don't really speak English that well. As they lived here longer and longer in America, they became like more accepting to like the different cultures and also like the language. I would say my parents like struggles with the neighborhood. It's just really struggles that maybe a first time homeowner would face. They really didn't understand like, oh, different mortgage payments at first or like all this other financial stuff. But like as time moved on, they got to know it pretty well. I would do a lot of translation for my parents at a young age. Even as early as elementary school, I would basically be the translator at parent-teacher conferences, which kind of takes the point away from parent-teacher conference because I'm just sitting there translating what my teacher said to my mom or dad. Or just like even calling up Verizon to like help with phone bill. Even though it was like under my parents' name, at like 8 or 9, we'd be making these calls. So just like learning how to do that. Young dad definitely helped me grow up really fast. So just like those small things like that, I think that gave me a lot of responsibilities early on. One of the driving factors in my life is just like look back to move forward. Just like really understanding like what you've done in the past and then like how can you do like more interesting things with it later on in the future. You have all these politicians making all these promises, but then you have to like measure like how feasible different policies are. So in terms of Coney Island in general, I'm very interested in economic development. I mean, I know I'm very like proud to be coming from Coney Island, but just like, you know, having a mindset to like being able to like raise a family here, just like encouraging more people to come in here. I really like see that in the future.
In 2003, Mayor Bloomberg announced his massive rezoning project for Coney Island. The proposal would reduce the area's zone for amusements and allow high-rise residential development. Real estate speculators began buying and flipping property in the heart of the amusement district. A condo developer paid shopping mall developer Thor Equities $95 million for a lot that had sold for $13.5 million a year earlier. By 2005, Thor had acquired 12 acres of amusement property. Tenants were evicted and rent soared. It seemed as if the days of Coney Island's independent operators might be coming to an end. In this 2016 oral history, Candy Raphael, whose family was among the handful of independent game operators remaining on Coney Island's Bowery, describes what it was like to work here. Raphael started helping out as an 8-year-old and says, "I can't give up Coney Island. It's my home."
I grew up here from, I want to say, the age of 1 till, you know, like my whole life, basically. I'm going to be 22 years old, later this month. And I've just grew up on the Bowery doing what most people do out here, which is work yourself to death, practically. But it's, I have to say, made me a better person, at least. Because it taught me, you know, hard work and creativity and all that stuff on how to actually, you know, accomplish things that you want to do. If you want something out here, you have to work for it and you have to work for it hard. And honestly, I have to say that's made me a better person right now.
So what games do you primarily operate?
Water race games, which could be the balloon pop game, or what we had was the Bart Simpson game. I've also worked in a basketball game, a BB gun game, football game. I've worked in you know the milk toss game where you have to throw the ball at the bottles, knock them over?
I do.
I've had to work one of those. Most summers, that's the one I operate. but I bounce between different jobs. If I could practically do all of them, you know, learning how to repair the guns if they act up or how to fix just about anything in that building. For the most part, the stuff that's been installed in there, some of it is from the previous owners and others is stuff that my dad put in or replaced. And we rent the building, but, you know, we put in all the work for it.
How old were you when you first operated a game?
I want to say about 8. I believe the game that I was working in was a water race game. When my dad originally got it, it had the Bart Simpson hookup. And I used to talk on the microphone. And I actually had a speech impediment for a long time. And went to the school and they were like, you know what, that's actually probably a really good way for me to learn how to speak better.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was terribly shy as a kid. I'm still, you know, shy at times, but I can work my game at least, you know?
What kind of things were you saying on the mic at 8?
Oh, like you want me to give you my whole
spiel? Yeah.
Step up, step over, step in, get ready to play, get ready to win, come give it a try, come stay, come play, come take a prize away, come on in, guys, don't be shy, don't just walk on by, come give it a try, guys, come on in, come on in, come on in. And it's just that whole thing over and over and over again, and that's like every day. I can do that and text and listen to music all at the same time and think, and it's sad because I've said it for so long now that I'm practically able to mix match it, bring it just whichever way I want.
And that's amazing that you got over a childhood speech impediment by that.
Yeah.
When you're on the mic, do you refer to yourself as a talker? There's a bit of discussion as to whether it's a barker or a talker.
Honestly, it depends on like how you view it. If somebody's just using a general say-all, whatever, to get people in, that's more of a barker than... Honestly, I consider myself a Coney Island original carny. That's just how it is, though. You know, I usually open weekdays. I want to say 12 o'clock if it's like the midsummer. And then weekends, we would probably start at like 10, 11, depending on if it was a holiday or not. And then at nighttime, it would be 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. We get off work. And unfortunately, you know, that's just how it is. You have to work. If you don't work, then... You know, you don't get anything. Yeah. And that's something my dad taught me for a long time.
And people think it's all fun and games here in Coney Island, but the fun and games are work. What are your favorite things about working on the Bowery?
My favorite things, I have to say, is probably the people. You know, obviously there's a lot of really jerky people, like really, really jerky people. But then it's those people who make your day, like when little kids come to my game, that's one of my favorite things because their eyes light up and they're just having so much fun. And it just reminds me of me when I grew up, you know, getting to go to all the different games and find a stuffed animal and fall in love. I still collect stuffed animals till this day because me growing up out here is such a great memory for me.
As the city pushed its massive redevelopment plan, the owners of Astroland were kept in the dark about how their amusement park would be affected by the rezoning. Abstract renderings and vague assurances did not make it clear whether the Albert family's property would receive the same zoning as the adjacent properties being purchased by speculative developers. Carol Albert worked with an architect to come up with a viable plan for Astroland that matched the city's proposal to turn Coney Island into a year-round destination. After a lack of commitment from the city, Albert became discouraged about the chances for implementing her own plan and sold the property to Thor Equities in 2006. For the next 2 years, Astroland operated under a lease agreement and closed for good on September 7th, 2008. In this 2022 oral history, Eric Sanchez, who grew up in Coney Island in Gravesend, shares his memories of Astroland and the Siren Festival.
When I was first born, we lived in Coney Island. I don't quite remember that, but I've always lived in very far, like South Brooklyn, like Coney Island, Gravesend, Bath Beach. But anyway, we moved to my grandmother and great-grandmother's place, which was on 2121 Short Parkway. And that was like literally right before Coney Island. We lived on West 15th and Neptune, which was not necessarily like the nicest place to be, but I still enjoyed my time over there. I would go out pretty often, especially like if it was like the off season in Coney Island and like a little late when everything's like kind of shut down. I would go and grab like a slice of pizza from Pizza on the Run and just kind of like eat that and wander through like all the closed rides or arcades. And I would hear what I heard later on was called like the Coney Island Howl, and it was coming from the Astro Tower. I didn't know it at the time, but it was this big, loud, sort of like eerie but serene, whistling, whirling kind of loud noise. And I would just wander like by the cyclone. There's a little alley where even though everything's closed, you could walk up towards where there's entrance towards a Wonder Wheel, and then it would make like an L shape, so you can make a right turn and still kind of walk through just like all the closed like little mini like arcades and fortune teller stands and stuff. So I'd walk through that, walk on the boardwalk, and just I'd spend a lot of time kind of just hang out with myself over there by myself. I always had just like a real peaceful, almost like meditative experience just wandering through there. And at kind of like, you know, 17, 18 is a time where kind of thinking about life and decisions and growing up and being an adult. And so really kind of had a time where, even if I didn't find those answers, sort of exploring what that was like. I spent my time just wandering and thinking through Coney Island, trying to figure those things out. And one day I saw that Electric Six was playing the Siren Festival in Coney Island. Siren Festival was like, it's such a shame this doesn't happen anymore, but it was by towards the end, it was huge. I think they had like two big stages. They would often have, I think it was ran by the Village Voice. They would have a lot of local acts and a lot of like bigger acts come through. There's like Death Cab for Cutie, Hot Hot Heat, Electric Six, which is like at their height. And I think they had a big stage by the Cyclone, and they had a big stage by Stillwell, like near Nathan's towards the boardwalk. And again, all ages, free shows for like people to come through. And I saw Electric Six and I was like really blown away. They're just, it hit me at a place where it's like, I don't always need like such deep meaning in music. I just want like this like kind of fun, good time, but like still good music. So I went other years, but I hadn't really found, it was a time where I feel like a lot of the bands that were playing, I was too cool for them now. So it was all a big time where like more so like emo or screamo type of bands are around. I never really liked those so much. We'd all kind of hunker down somewhere on the sand, and whoever wanted to go see whatever band would usually like go leave, see them and come back. So I didn't really check out too many other bands at the Siren Festival. It's such a mixed thing because I feel like there was and still is, but even more so then, like a bit of a difference, judgments aside, but a difference between what were like, you know, the locals or people from Brooklyn and like the people that moved to Brooklyn, right? So there would be like me, my friends that were maybe a little more like alternative, a little more goth view, whatever. And then we'd see the people, we'd be like, oh, those are the hipsters coming in for the hipster bands playing today. And those would be the people that we'd be like, you moved into like Williamsburg and now you're maybe coming down just for this show and then you're going to leave.
The first decade of the 21st century was a tumultuous era that shaped and is still shaping the Coney Island of today. After years of lobbying and political arm twisting, the rezoning of Coney Island was passed by the New York City Council on July 29, 2009, much to the disappointment of advocates who wanted the amusement zone expanded instead of reduced. The residential component of the plan allows 30 high-rise towers as tall as the parachute jump to be built on land that was formerly zoned only for amusements and public parkland. After Mayor Bloomberg was elected for a third term, the city bought 6 acres of Thor Equity's land, including the Astroland site, for $95.6 million and issued a request for proposals for a single operator to build a new amusement park on the site. Luna Park opened in May 2010. There was good news on the environmental front in 2003 when Keyspan Energy settled with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation and began a $114 million cleanup at Coney Island Creek. The 16-acre brownfield site and the adjacent bed of the creek had been severely polluted by a coal gasification facility that had operated at that location for many decades. The long-neglected estuary was finally getting the attention it deserved. Our last narrator, Abby Jordan, describes her special connection to the water and nature as a member of Coney Island Brighton Beach Open Water Swimmers and a volunteer with the Billion Oyster Project at Coney Island Creek. Jordan is a Brighton Beach native whose Salvadoran immigrant parents have been homeowners in the community for over 35 years.
So I brought you something. This is just one of the many things I pick up on my walks. It's like life upon life. So it's a random shell from the beach, but there's barnacles all over it, which I think is like a great analogy for what Coney Island is like. You have such like condensed people living like inside the island. You have immigrant communities everywhere. And then on top of all that is that the proximity to the Atlantic Ocean, and there is the beach that is beautiful and clean most of the year until summer comes, when unfortunately it does get a little bit trashed, but it is a beautiful place to live and be in. Growing up, my mom and my dad would take us to the boardwalk a lot, like very often. And a lot of our photos when we were little are of my brother and I and my mom at the beach. She had sent us to learn swimming at a pool, but she and my grandmother, my abuelita de arriba, they made sure that we spent a lot of time in the water. And the house was full of seashells and sand and rocks. And we were always, you know, by the water and by the beach, which I think is another thing of being economical. We didn't, like, my parents, I guess, they were very upfront. We didn't have enough money to do like cruises and things like that. So vacations for us consisted of swimming, playing in the sand, and then going to El Salvador for a couple of weeks or months to spend time with my mom and my father's family out there. I swim on my own to try to escape the city and not think about my commute. And I spend a lot of time on the boardwalk by myself, just to like have a little bit of extra space away from home. The whole ocean thing really came about from my abuelita de arriba, my father's mom. She would wake up very early and go swimming. So over the years, I kind of did use my opportunity to be alone and in the water as my way to just remember her. My parents are Salvadorian. We speak Spanish at home. I do feel very much like a Latina, like a first gen, like Salvadorian American. But my neighborhood is all Russian. And growing up, everyone spoke Russian. And everyone now speaks Russian, even if they're from ex-USSR states like Georgia, Kazakhstan. We have a lot of Uzbeks. My neighbors are Uzbek. I guess the language barrier was not really a problem, because when you live in such close proximity with people and you share so many things, they become like family. So I do have several neighbors within my general vicinity that we're very close to, have been friends and family of my parents, my grandparents, and now me for many years. So that's good. But in terms of like the community, yeah, if for a very long time I did feel like an outsider in my own home until I started to like assimilate, I learned very basic Russian. I would talk more to like the shopkeepers. I started to make more friends in the neighborhood that was my age. So that really helped. But that also means like leaving your past convictions behind and being a little bit more open-minded to assimilating to your own community instead of having your community assimilate to what you think America should be. And my Russian is horrible. It's absolutely horrible. But my friends and the neighbors and the store owners who have taught me a little bit are like, Maladiots, like you're trying, we're proud of you, but it's really bad. Over the past couple of years, I have found ways to get work experience in environmental sector, talking about conservation and protecting communities that are in the coast, or promoting education that's science-based. So thankfully, the Billion Oyster Project is something that I've been able to be a part of. I started volunteering a couple years ago, and they recently launched more projects here in Coney Island that's like going to the community and talking to students about what are oysters? What are these communities' relationship with their natural surroundings? That's an estuary. It's Coney Island Creek. There's a lot of little things that even I'm learning. And then once I learn, I get to talk to students about that, which is great because I didn't really have that growing up. And I totally understand the need for science-based education and outreach in New York City specifically. And there are a lot of coastal communities in New York City, evident with Sandy, with how many communities were hit and affected by the storm, and unfortunately the coming storm surges that will happen in the future. So hopefully, you know, over the years, more people will start getting engaged in volunteering for projects like BOP. recently was the seagrass planting with the Parks Department. So they have a pilot program in front of the aquarium and out in front of the Coney Island houses. So there are small plots where there's seagrass that was planted by community members. And then hopefully, you know, a little sand dune will propagate and there'll be seagrass. So things like that will foster more people to be engaged with their community and realize, wow, we're on an island. That's an ocean. This is great. There is nature, and there is a way to connect nature and urban communities together.
Thank you for listening to Coney Island Stories, the Coney Island History Project podcast. This episode was produced by Charles Denson, Ali Lemer, and Trisha Vita. Music by Blue Dot Sessions. The oral histories were conducted by Cara Baptiste, Allison Corbett, Amanda Deutsch, Samira Tazari, and Lauren Vespoli between 2015 and 2022. You can listen to the full interviews featured in this podcast in our oral history archive at ConeyIslandHistory.org. If you have a question or would like to record an oral history, contact us via Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or our website. Stay tuned for Season 3 of Coney Island Stories in 2023.
This program is supported in part by Humanities New York, with funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities.